to be Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falconstein from Falcon Screen. We're joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Oh, yeah.
And freelance writer and critic for Rotten Eru.
I have returned, much like James Bond.
He has. It's been 6 years. There's been a 2-year delay since the intended, already announced release of No Time to Die. It is in cinemas now. We are finally very excited you covered it. It is mine and Virat's favorite film series, so we have a lot to talk about. Come the podcast, we're going to be talking No Time to Die spoilers, as well as a little bit more about the Sydney Film Festival On Demand series. Before we do that, we want to touch very quickly on news of the week. The British Film Festival continues, as does the Italian Film Festival around the country. The Japanese Film Festival is in full swing in Sydney from tomorrow, the 25th. The Melbourne Queer Film Festival continues. The Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival continues online. Filmonic Melbourne is happening tonight during our session, so you can tune into that later. The Scandinavian Film Festival, long awaited, arrived in Sydney yesterday, and Static Vision Film Collective have a weekend of film making dreamscapes in Melbourne come tomorrow night, and then following that in Sydney come December 1st through 5th at Pink Flamingo. There'll be an equivalent and very similar program. And now we continue with No Time to Die. No Time to Die is in cinemas now. It is the 25th James Bond film. It is the fifth and final, officially second time, final Bond film starring Daniel Craig. I say that, it sounds saccharine. I'm glad he's back.
Did they ever officially say a previous one was the final Daniel Craig Bond though, right?
I'd rather slit my wrist than do another Bond film, which kind of felt like you didn't want to do
it. It was a negotiating tactic. It was a very good negotiating tactic. Reportedly, they actually did drive a truck of money up to his house. It was worth it. It is also starring Lea Seydoux, Rami Malek, Ralph Fiennes, and Ana de Armas, which we'll talk about further. It is, by way of plot explanation, a James Bond film, which doesn't quite do justice, and we'll get into that in a moment. We'll talk about spoilers come the podcast. I think before we get into the degree, I have one among a number of general observations. James Bond, like Mission Impossible, like a lot of the major franchises, have moved from serialization to anthologization. This became really marked in the early Craig era, and it's become, it seems like, the raison d'etre of the series at this moment. I don't actually mind that. I don't think it's happened with No Time to Die, but I wonder if the series continues on this path, that it will lose the simple enjoyment of individual installments. I think Quantum of Solace let the series down in this regard. I think you can enjoy that without really appreciating the Casino Royale. I think you can enjoy No Time to Die as a standalone installment. I don't mind anthologization, but I think with Marvel, and we've seen this a little bit with James Bond, there's an issue where enjoyment is dependent upon, from a commercial perspective, seeing the others. And I think from pure narrative perspective, where you should just be able to enjoy a film when it's lonesome, that in minor respects, that lets No Time to Die down.
It's the rise of the TV storytelling HBO model. You know, it's infected everything in entertainment, where it's like, okay, people like getting invested in a story over a long time and watching the next episode. But the thing is, with things like the MCU or James Bond, to me, you can never really get the joy of a serialized TV show, because like you're watching something made by a number of different creators where each episode has its own kind of different tone and feel. Even though there's consistent characters, they don't really feel like a serial to me. They feel like different movies pretending to be aligned with each other.
James Bond more so than Mission Impossible and the other ones that have moved to, we have to have these installment by installment.
Yeah.
Turning to, everyone talks about who the best James Bond is. I honestly think it's Daniel Craig. He has done something that I think Dalton tried to do but couldn't do so extensively over the course of two films, and has developed a real character, James Bond. Importantly, I think each of the six actors have done so, but there is a much more distinctive character. He does the action scenes, he does the physicality, he does the charm, he does the one-liners.
He's
had the longest tenure as Bond. I like Connery. I like Dalton a lot, but Dalton only had two films.
Yeah.
I think Craig collectively is the best. And I think that was solidified with Spectre, but I think it was really solidified with this film.
I think Dalton would be my favorite if he were given the opportunity to do many more, but I like Craig as Bond. But I don't know. I was ready to move on from Daniel Craig in this role by the end of this film, though. I don't know. So there's something about like the kind of, maybe it's not so much Craig, who is excellent, as it is the kind of dreary tone that comes with him.
I mean, just to play devil's advocate, Daniel Craig is quite old, and his age does show in some sequences. And that was a bit
not like Roger Moore, though.
You see, I disagree. Here's the thing. Roger Moore was significantly older. Connery, Craig was actually one of the youngest to start the role. Craig was 36 when he started. Brosnan was 42. Moore and Connery were 39. But Craig has had the longest tenure. But remember, the strange thing with Craig is Moore's a little bit of an exception. With Craig, it's because it's been 15 years, you can see the gamut from young upstart to reary. We're about to go into Roger Moore territory because I'm tired and over this. Unfortunately, I think Skyfall kickstarted this because you had two films that were at the immediate beginning of this Bond's career, and suddenly you're talking about old dog, new tricks a few years later. So they very quickly wanted to talk about Craig from a has-been Bond perspective, but didn't really have this big middle era where he's just going on adventures. So I think Craig is done with the series. I think he did it because for the enormous pile of money. So it doesn't bother me that, with respect to age and all the age of any other characters, if he can do the physicality role, if he can pull off the role, I believe he does here. So that didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he can't do the physical moves and stuff, but yes, maybe you're right. Maybe that's actually the point where he never had a middle era. And suddenly, with Skyfall, Spectre, and now No Time to Die, you have three back-to-back Bond films where the shtick is that, you know, you're a man out of time, and basically it's old dog playing new tricks kind of thing. So it does feel that he's leaning into the older Bond more than the younger Bond, even though you're right, he started as the youngest Bond.
But I do have to give this film credit in respects. A lot of the Bond, really Skyfall, there were only individual installments where, you know, MI6 and itself hung in the balance, where there was this heavy meta aspect to the series, World Was Not Enough being an example. And then for several successive films, it was all about MI6 falling apart. It was really going to, we have to do something quote unquote special here. I'm just fine with Bond going on adventures. Actually went back to a more traditional, oh, we're just going to see a guy wanting to destroy the world, something we'll get into in a little bit.
I want to see MI6 be capable and not compromised for once. I get that they want to reflect the Bond series, and they want to reflect the social milieu that drove the popularity of the Bond series of we don't trust the government, conspiracies are everywhere. I mean, it makes sense why people don't want to trust a government agent in this day and age. But just in terms of pure plot, it's getting boring to see, MI6 is compromised and Bond has to go rogue every time. Mission Impossible is the same, by the way, but James Bond has a more storied history. Can we not go back to some of the other ways?
Mission Impossible did it from Mission Impossible 1. Like, that was the actual coda of that series. Where
that's true. Is Mission Impossible 2 the only one where he doesn't have to go rogue?
Let me think about this. Three, yes, it is the only one.
Yes.
The only one where he doesn't have to go rogue.
If CIA were right in the last one, it's time to get rid of the IMF.
Yeah, they were totally on board. And it's probably time to get rid of MI6 too, because it's worse than what Chris has said. This series and this film in particular, to its credit, have a internal logic. Obviously, all Bond films are insane, but this one is consistently insane, which is fine. As long as it's a consistent level, I'm good with that. The problem is that the entire plot hinges on not just MI6 screwing up, but repeatedly screwing up in morbid, insane, world-ending ways. And come on, you should fire these guys. Like, get rid of them, dissolve them, get the IMF in. I mean, for their level, relative to the level of competence, come on.
Okay, I saw this film as a satire as to like how governments keep growing up and yet we keep electing them because that's our only choice. Anyway.
A little bit. There are funny bits where like, how could you get away with bombing this? Surely this foreign powerful nation might have something to say about this.
Okay, so one thing we've skipped over. What's it about?
You've kind of summed it up by saying it's a James Bond movie. But what's it actually about?
The Terra Australis Readers and Writers Festival is on this weekend. An online, international crime and mystery literary festival. A criminally good lineup. Anne Cleves, Val McDermott, Gary Disher, Candace Fox, Solari Gentile, Anita Heiss, and more. There's interviews, book clubs, masterclasses, and panels. Hurry, get your tickets for this online event at terraaustralisfestival.com. Terra Australis Festival sponsors 2SER. 107.3.
What it is about, it's actually a very cool basic plot from the reading of this film about a guy who is who has an impact we see on Madeleine Swann and her family in an earlier time in her life, played by Lea Seydoux, and he's from this individual's relationship with Spectre. The antagonism between the villain in this and Spectre is something that I thought was really, really interesting. That's a great and it's an original plot for a James Bond series. Unfortunately, there's an event that happens halfway through the film where that switches and that motivation changes. And following that, it just turns into a very broad, nondescript, we want to get rid of the world and all that. Now, to be very clear, I don't have a problem with villains in James Bond films who just want to, you know, burn everything down. But you look at the comparable villains in other films, and there's always a reason for it. In Moonraker, the guy was a eugenicist and thought he was better than other people. In The Spy Who Loved Me, he was an environmentalist and wanted to save the ocean. So there's a little bit of social commentary underlying these films, whereas in this one, it's just, oh, they'll accept that this guy, Thanos-style, wants to destroy the world. It's actually not good enough, even for Bond films.
I agree that the villain sucks, but before we get onto that,
it always sucks. It sucks for only the second half of the film.
I have to explain what the film
is. He was decent.
James Bond is reunited with Madeline Swann at the end of the last film, Spectre. And at the beginning, he's what he thinks is a betrayal from her. So the two go their separate ways. MI6 have messed things up again. So they need to go back and find Bond because he's the only person that Blofeld, who is under the capture of MI6, will speak to. So Madeline Swann and Bond are drawn back together, and Spectre seem to be involved, but there's another man pulling the strings. Could it be Academy Award winner Rami Malek? Back to you, Glenn.
Could it be? He's good in this. This is the thing. All the actors around Craig is good, but Alea Seydoux, Rami Malek are just operating on other levels. I think Malik is someone who, like, again, to use the Mission Impossible analogy, Philip Seymour Hoffman, can handle the I just want to burn everything down mentality. They've really deferred to the classic Bond villain tropes here. Russian with, you know, facial scars. You'll be bad.
Film is a bit of a throwback, right? Mm-hmm. This is a contemporary Bond, but I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were talking about at the beginning the symbolism of Bond trapped in the 50s car. It's not exactly a 50s car, but like it's the throwback. And this film is really playing on, I think, one, Dr. No, and two, on Her Majesty's Secret Service. There's a lot of homages to those two films running throughout. There's homages to other Bond ones, but those were, I think, the most consistent threads. But yes, Rami Malek, I think he did a decent enough job. I don't think he was amazing in it, but he was good enough. But the issue for me was that I don't think his character is that well written. I think his motivation is unclear, and he's taken extremely seriously.
Not for the first part at all.
Sure, but you know, when it really becomes about him and exploring him in the second half and explaining what that motivation was, they're trying very hard to present this as extremely serious, but a sillier tone would have worked when at the end of the day, what everything seems to boil down to is, ha 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 ha, I am bad.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. This is a very silly movie with no internal logic, as Glenn just pointed out.
That's not what I said at all. I said there is inconsistent internal logic, even if it's insane. That's my point.
Okay, sorry. Consistently insane internal logic,
which
would work in a silly movie, except it's trying to be super serious all the time, which is what sort of...
There's some silly scenes early on. There's some silly scenes.
For me, the serious parts are kind of like, I think of it like a lot of the Marvel films, and also particularly Guardians of the Galaxy 2, where how they treat Yondu, where they have these bits where there's this indiscriminate killing and you're supposed to have fun with this, but then they want you to really invest in James Bond as a character. I think we shouldn't have to invest in James Bond as a character, but there is a surface level of engagement which doesn't come unless you have a film like License to Kill, which is a nitty gritty, okay, we're really seeing the impact of small scale violence here. Whereas here it's on, there's a scene later in the film, it's decently staged, but it's just a video game involving a set of stairs, and you can't switch really, and the film doesn't really manage to flick from that to the super sincere elements which it uses to anchor the final scenes of the film.
I agree. You hit the nail on the head earlier on when we were talking about Rami Malek, and you were saying in the first half of the film, because this film hits a point where it goes rapidly downhill. Every single person I've spoken to who's seen it agrees.
First exactly half, 90 minutes.
The second half,
it's 90 minutes in.
Well, I think it's still good, but the first like nearly 2 hours, it is a very long film. It is an indulgently long film.
Too long.
Much stronger than the later half. I did enjoy the later half. And
just everything about it becomes, I think, more just kind of by the book in that second
half. So operatic. It goes into homage territory, and it's a send-off to Craig.
Soap opera, just as long as it's consistent. A lot of the Bond films are soap operas. And this is another thing, just in terms of the internal logic of the film, the cachet of Bond, and something I've always loved, is up until Dying of the Day, they've always had believable, practical action. This means they stage smaller scale stuff, and that's fine because I know stunt person's doing amazing work. In this, and in the past few films, but really in this, they're pushing increasingly for CGI. There's one scene early in the film, and it mirrors a scene in Skyfall where you see Craig going on a motorcycle doing these stunts. You know it's not real. I think that lets down the Bond films a bit. We accept the level of artifice in films, and certainly more so with, I think, Bond films, where we know it's a stunt person doing cool stunts. We just want to see the stunts. The amazing scene in Italy where he jumps onto the funeral procession, that was actually filmed for real, but because of the CGI they added to it, it just looks and feels kind of fake. And I wish, even you referred to the old absurd Moore era, even in View to a Kill, the scenes, the Paris car chase, the jump off the Eiffel Tower, that's real. You know it's real. And there's a compulsion and a kick from it. And even the dummy falling on the bloody barge was better than a lot of the CGI in this. And I wish they'd move back to the, I think, what people expect and really enjoy from the series. And they didn't a lot in this film.
Well, to mention Mission Impossible Fallout again, at the beginning of that movie, there's a scene that they filmed for real with Tom Cruise jumping out of a plane. But when you look at it, because they added these CGI storm clouds to it, you register the whole thing as CGI. Same mistake here in this film. If you film something for real, leave the image alone, because once you start adding all these digital elements everywhere, the mind sees them, and the mind is so conditioned to think everything I'm looking in front of me is a computer trick, that once you're registering those, the verisimilitude is out the window.
And perfectly to Chris's point, as analogous, almost exactly 20 years ago to the day prior to Fallout, Tomorrow Never Dies filmed a Halo jump, and it was great.
It was great, yeah, and it registers as real.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of elements to this film where people are going to say, you can't do that. You're going outside the conventions of James Bond, particularly elements of the ending, which we'll discuss later in the spoiler section. However, I actually disagree with this. There's always been a consistency with Bond where there's the renewal of character. Every new Bond is a character. Sometimes actors join new Bonds. Sometimes Bonds join new actors. And Moneypenny's and M's and Q's will stay on.
Bond is loosely canon.
This is consistent with how they handled.
Yeah, things are consistent, some things aren't. They get to pick and choose. Bond can have its own canon. I'm fine with that. But yeah. I think to discuss the ramifications of this, we'll have to go into the spoiler episode. So, you know.
Absolutely.
iTunes and Spotify, wherever else good podcasts are found, you can hear the rest of those thoughts at the 30-minute mark, roughly, of the episode. Yep. Anyway.
Now in its 25th year, the Japanese Film Festival Australia is back in Sydney cinemas from November 25 to December 5th. Featuring action, romance, mystery, comedy, documentary, and of course, anime, with a special Shuji Teriyama retrospective included. For more information, visit JapanesefilmFestival.net. The Japanese Film Festival Australia, presented by the Japan Foundation Sydney, proudly sponsors 2SER.
You're listening to Film Fight Club and 2SER with Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Bharat Nehru. Before we get into some of the technical aspects, I just want to note Bond has, I think, mostly not exclusively due to Diamonds Are Forever, a very unfortunate and bad history as regards LGBT representation. And there's a scene in this film where a character mentions casually that they're gay. And I think that's great. I think that's a good form of representation. I think the series in many respects has come a long way. And another element the series has been very criticized for is its depiction of women and misogyny. I think importantly, and I appreciate the Craig films have done this, they haven't actually changed the character. They've just moved the perception for the most part from being someone you glamorize to being a tragic figure that you wouldn't want to emulate. So I think that's fine. I think it's okay to portray this behavior as long as it's front of the lens of this is what we clearly think of this character. And I think the Craig films are mostly good in that regard, including this one. So I give the film credit for that.
I think they mostly strike a good balance. I think a lot of people have difficulty these days with the idea that endorsement is not the same as depiction. Yeah. And I agree, Bond is a tragic figure. I think Bond works best as a tragic figure. I think we're sick today of this kind of person just being glamorized, and you can't play straight Bond, you know, as an empowerment figure. Maybe we'll get more into this when we get into the spoilers, but you talking about the idea of bringing up to date the representation of women and LGBT representation and things like that, it always runs us up against this idea that Bond is a figure of the past. So I don't know. I was going to open a can of worms. We probably shouldn't get into this now and stick to the film, but it's all, sort of like, why should we keep making Bond films and try to modernize them instead of just sort of moving on from this character?
Fine with it. GoldenEye started it, and this, the whole, this, the line in Quantum of Solace, I have no friends. Like, yeah, I figure that you're a person who would have friends, and that's not good. You're not someone who would want to sort of like forgotten to lead.
You don't want to have a beer with Bond. That's the thing. A Heineken with the logo showing it toward the camera.
He's such an arrogant prick. Like, honestly.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, the first 90 minutes of this movie is so visually inventive and cool, right? Like, there's a raid early on with a spinning camera that I thought was one of the best staged action scenes I've ever seen in a Bond movie. The opening action before the credits was terrific, and the screening I was in, people cheered. There's interesting plot twists, etc.
It's very well, and there's momentum to this film.
Yes. And the characters early on, at least, are interesting, at least within the template of this plot. They're interesting.
Yeah. We have to talk about Ana de Armas.
Yes.
Ana de Armas is the real takeaway from this. And this is a big call. But relative to the amount of time she spends on screen, I honestly think she's the best Bond girl. It's a short period, but she's very, very good. And to be clear, she's good in terms of that. She's both the action, she does the action-driven stuff amazingly well. The physicality in the scene is good. She's incredibly funny, but she also manages this converse guilelessness. And let's just be blunt, she's great to look at. Like, she hits all the criteria of what a Bond girl is. She's someone, a character or a figure I could totally see just appearing in multiple Bond films. There's no reason if we can't have M's and other characters and Felix Leiter appearing here and there, we can't have a recurring character like this. Paloma, she's absolutely amazing. I loved her in this. I can't, like, no faults at all.
I mean, it's been a while since we've had a Bond girl who's given teenage boys great dreams. So, I mean, welcome back to the original Bond girl fan.
I feel like it's been like one Bond film since then.
But that feels like really a long time. It feels like a long time because of the gap.
Leah Sedona fans are sitting there just thinking, excuse me?
Yeah, look, dude, you're severely underestimating the horniness of teenage boys, okay? They have imaginative minds. They're inventive. But let's not go into those sordid waters.
Yeah.
Ana de Armas, right? Her character is a great reversal in the way that she initially is portrayed as a ditz and then flips that impression on her head without the movie looking like it's trying to score points, without the movie loudly announcing, look, we're actually being progressive. Look, how she, you know, it's just properly played into the plot, and it's fun to watch. And the action scene.
No Marvel girl power moment.
Sorry?
There's no Marvel girl boss moment, thankfully.
Exactly. The script for this film is way too smart for that. And, you know, around this point in the film, I was actually having a similar thought. So it's funny you say that, which is, it's so refreshing to be watching a big budget, well-written action movie that is not following the Marvel formula, because that studio and its imitators have dominated nearly everything, or at least that's how it feels in the blockbuster space. So back to this action scene with Ana de Armas, it's fun, it's silly. It incorporates the idea of Bond's alcoholism in a really funny and inventive way, where, you know, drinks are coming his way and he's downing them while shooting.
I forgot about that. So good.
And there's teamwork. There's teamwork between him and the other important new female character, female agent in this film, that's really well choreographed. This whole section of the film, is, as I said before, inventive in the action, inventive in the visuals. I would say, though it doesn't have such tricky cinematography as Skyfall, overall, I feel like this film's better invented and more visually striking than Skyfall. So of recent ones, right up there at the top. Lots of interesting plot twists. The way Blofeld is used in this, I would say that Christoph Waltz is wasted in this, as he was in Spectre.
He's still good. I still enjoyed seeing him.
But he's still good, and the way he's used in the plot is interesting at this point in the narrative. You're trying to see how all the threads will come together. It's going in weird and
eerie.
It's eerie. In following up this Ana de Armas action scene, it's going in interesting directions. How's it all going to come together? It's a little bit unpredictable at this point. And then,
all right.
This is a stumbling
block. Yeah, before we get into some of the things that are lesser, Lashana Lynch as 007 is very, very good. Again, handles the action scene. She's really funny. and someone you absolutely believe could be a double agent in this universe. So thoroughly enjoyed her appearance.
Some context there, because Bond's retired and gone off the radar at the beginning of this film, there's a new 007.
Importantly, she has the only good one-liner in the film. It's the title drop. It's very, very good. The other one-liner is mostly not good. And that's where I have to talk. Some elements, like the writing of the quote-unquote Bond girls, are great. The hench persons in this film leave a great deal to be desired. Billy McNusson is playing this dude bro, or as Craig says at this Book of Mormon figure, he's very boring.
The Book of Mormon guy. That was a good one liner. You have to give credit where credit's due.
It's a little bit funny.
It's a little bit funny.
A little bit funny, sure. It was my second favorite, in relatively speaking. The other villain, who is referred to as Cyclops, is just kind of boring. And I think it's not the writing, it's the actor here. It really hammy. You look at Del Toro in License to Kill. It's not a very well-written character, but Del Toro is just so goddamn amazing, it makes it work. Here is a more well-written character played by a lesser actor, and it's just kind of, he's entirely forgettable, unfortunately.
It's just the shtick. It's just the gimmick of, like, here's a Bond character. But there's also some issues with how this guy's writing and figured it into the narrative that you see is done. I keep teasing what we'll talk about in the spoiler thing. I should zip my mouth shut.
Yeah, but we'll get to the spoiler. I want to mention, while there's an elegant hark back to the first couple of films involving Vesper at the beginning of this, I really liked that. I never thought that Léa Seydoux and Craig had quite the chemistry that the pair had in the first film. However, I think Seydoux is great. I like this aspect of the story. There's a very moving scene where we cover his relationship with Vesper early in the film. So this film involves nanobots, and I know people are laughing at this, but I think the nanobots are cool.
Why can't nanobots be in Bond?
Why not?
Cool. Like, Bond has had an invisible car. What's so weird about nanobots?
I think that was the most believable thing about the film. I was like, okay, cool. It's finally to see Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll talk about the villain's lair and spoilers. I really liked the production design here. It was a really cool space. Mm. It reminded me again of Dr. No and You Only Live Twice and some of the classically staged lairs. Also in this part of the world that isn't, I guess, as well known in Western culture. So it had an air of
criticism. Bond's ties to its past. You know, before we go into spoiling it, though, can we say, before we wrap up this episode, why we think it starts to falter in the second half? For me, it got bogged down in the dreariness of it. For me, the emotional sincerity stopped coming across so much. I started to feel like the film was overplaying this kind of deep sincerity. What did you guys think?
Absolutely.
I think my biggest problem was it became too apparent for me in the last hour that they were trying to go for this big emotionally resonant moment and building up to that, and nothing was landing and nothing felt as if any of that was actually important. And even when the moment comes, it felt like, you know, off with a bang but with a whimper kind of a thing.
It just you just can't anchor this sort of sincerity so immediately and so often after the play out, like GoldenEye, the video game, not the film, importantly. Yeah. Where it can be done. Look against a GoldenEye with the archive scene where a lot of people dying, but it feels sincere. It feels like, okay, we're reckoning with the cost of the loss of human life here. And this comes back in the scenes where he's talking to the Talia in Cuba. So this can be done well in a Bond film. It just wasn't done well here, or at least attempted here.
And we flipped from this very pulpy storytelling where you're enjoying the twists and turns to the deeply serious kind of tone where even the action scenes have this kind of dreary feel. I don't think that sentiment, as you were saying, Glenn, was anchored properly in the film. And I think even as it moves into we're going to the villain's lair, a lot of that material is lacking the visual invention and the twistiness. It's more just kind of staid and heavy, and I think this was a miscalculation, but we'll get onto this further shortly on the podcast.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Film Fight Club, where we're talking before we get into the spoilers for No Time to Die, the Sydney Film Festival final wrap.
Yeah, so on the weekend, me and Virat watched Radiograph of a Family, and I also watched Reconciliation as part of the On Demand. It was a pretty hectic weekend for me. I wish I had time to talk about and watch more films. Hopefully I'll be able to catch up with some of the other movies I was planning on watching on the On Demand later. But in brief, Reconciliation has an amazing concept. It's about somebody who is being asked to forgive the person who accidentally, but there seems to be a degree of ambiguity here. The murder was not intentional, but to what degree was there an intent to cause harm, etc.? Seems to be an accident. Anyway, in Albania, where there's a tension between Christian morality and the old-fashioned morality and legal codes, which suggest that a year after somebody's murdered, if the other family hasn't paid in blood, forgiveness can be granted in exchange for money or acts of humility. And it's incredible in the sense of some of the raw emotion that's captured in this film, with the tension between the family that doesn't want to go along with this, saying, you know, money's not going to do anything, and you're asking me to believe in these laws over Jesus Christ, and what's the point of any of this? And the community that's saying, come on, be reasonable, go along with this. And the other family who really are not showing that much remorse, or because this involves a long-standing blood feud. Fascinating concept. Scenes of high emotion are captured, but the actual documentary is kind of plodding, not that well structured, I think, and features a lot of scenes that maybe were designed for symbolic import, like many scenes showing the selection and the building of this cross installation that's being installed, but ultimately it just slows the thing down. I think it's a case of a documentary being notable because the person was there in the right place at the right time with the camera, but the actual craft isn't there. On the other hand, Radiograph of a Family, I'd compare to Flea, another film we spoke about from the Sydney Film Festival, in that it uses reconstructions based on memories, dramatizations based on memories, this time not with animation, but mostly with stock footage and with photos and voiceovers played over photos of the director's family. This film is extremely well-structured and extremely well-made.
It's an Iranian family in the backdrop of the Iranian Revolution in 1979,
and
how the country changes from a more progressive to a more traditionally fundamentalist Islamic society. So that's
right.
Mirrored into her personal life as her own family becomes more conservative. It's a very interesting conceit, and it's followed through throughout the film. And I found that to be so compelling as to tell a personal story through a political way.
And the way that there's a mirror going on here, as you said, Virat, early on, this film is basically showing the divide in Iranian culture and society. Because early on, when we're telling the story of the director's mother, she comes from a very like religious fundamentalist family, and she ends up moving to Switzerland and seeing a different kind of life. And she's being asked to leave behind her ideals and modernize. Yeah. And she struggles with that. Then when she goes back to Iran, she sees with him later on, she sees another side of Iran she didn't know existed, which is very similar to what she saw in Switzerland. So there's that divide in Iran, and she becomes part of the revolutionary forces pushing it in the direction of religious fundamentalism. Ultimately, the director herself is you know, has the life that she was brought up with torn away from her because of this, in the same way that her mother did. It's a simple but really powerful story that shows you the power of religion and the way that we're all slaves of fundamental.
But also how this kind of narrative is beautifully structured together through found footage, a bit of family photographs. It has Kiarostami's 24 frames feel to it sometimes, because a lot of times you have photographs that have a lot of history behind them, which is unveiled while you're looking at the photograph, and then you go back to traverse between found footage and a memoir style documentary as well. So I love different styles being used seamlessly together, which is not like, consistent to one thing, but it's also
dramatic, family slideshow with this conceit of like camera gliding through this house and the way that the house changes. The use of that the shot gliding through the house reminds me of Tarkovsky's The Mirror, which is another film that uses found footage and reflects autobiography in an interesting way. I really love this film. It was such a sincere and simple act of empathy in trying to understand her parents and what they went through. Sometimes the emotional directness like that works the best. You don't need to, it's just a brilliant conceit, and you don't need to try really hard to move people, like No Time to Die, which we're about to get back into. Sometimes just being simple and honest is the best way. And the power of this story sells itself, you know. And this movie, despite being really constrained in the way that it's made, has a real depth in its image making.
It was quickly become one of my best films of the year. It won the competition at IFFA Documentary Film Festival. Really deserved it. I think
I suspect that even though I didn't catch many films in the on-demand, that this was probably one of the picks of them, because I can't imagine that many were better than this. This is really good.
So there's the Sydney Film Festival, and now we are back to No Time to Die.
Man, the Sydney Film Festival's over. There's no more.
But there are other
festivals. No Time to Die.
There's big films coming out by the end of the year. And you know what? We have the shortest time to wait, June 8th, I think it is, for Sydney Film Festival 69. We hope they do something special next year because use the MIFI iconography. But anyhow, it's only 9 months to wait, less.
To clarify, MIF put a giant 69 on their poster for the cancelled MIF 69.
I don't see Sydney doing that.
Yeah.
But we'll...
It might.
Well, we have not long. Not long to wait, but we are talking No Time to Die. Full spoiler warning, this from here on in, this is a spoiler discussion. We are spoiling No Time to Die.
Spoilers. Snape kills Dumbledore.
Some idiot ruined that for me. Andrew in high school. Still hate him. Anyway.
Maybe I should. Is it okay to say that as a joke now? Are we past this?
No, we're past it. It's like the Truman Show is a, you know, simulation.
But here's the thing. I'm still feeling bad. Like, what if someone who doesn't know Harry Potter listens to our podcast? But that's the thing. No one who doesn't know that is going to be listening.
Relative time is fine. Like, there was the terrible Hobbs and Shaw film, which were in the end of Game of Thrones, only a few months after it came out. You need to wait a certain amount of time. That book came out in what, 04? 03? 04?
I think it's more like 05.
Okay, so it's been 16 years. Anyhow, we're not talking Harry Potter.
We're talking about how James Bond dies. He fucking dies. James Bond dies, guys.
Yeah.
Dead.
Yeah, and I love how they do it. They don't want to leave any ambiguity, so they have a missile hit him at point blank range. It's like, he is gone.
And you get to actually see him blow up. I was thinking that too. I was thinking, like, he's going to, will it be left ambiguous? And it's like, oh no, he's definitely dead.
Before we get into that, I want to note just quickly the hilarious ways in which MI6 screw up. They let a crazy eugenicist Russian scientist make personal phone calls from the lab to a supervillain so they can arrange for this bad nanobot virus to get out there. They let the supervillain who they've imprisoned continue to control his evil empire by literally his evil eye for, like, what, 6 years?
Speaking of the evil eye, the Cyclops dude. Yeah, what's up with, you pointed this out, what's up with how he's a Spectre guy at the beginning of the movie, and then they kill everyone from Spectre, and he remains the henchman? Did they just miss this in the rewrites?
I think there's probably one line they just probably cut, but this needed a small explanation. It's like, okay, you're the supervillain now. They all just migrate to the new Dr. Evil? Is that how it happens?
Yeah. You're right. Like, all the villains, you are now my leader.
Yeah, pretty much. Sure. I think they have a henchman for hire industry or something, or, like, you know, the where you get your party hat, you get your party henchman. Yeah. It's like, it's, yeah, you know, you're
sometimes they work like it.
It's like Star Wars 9, where, like, it's like Rami Malek has a billion Death Stars, so I guess we all work for him now.
Yeah, but basically the logic this film is working on. Yeah. So there's just so much. I love that what they refer to as disputed territory. It's technically Russian sovereign territory at the moment, but I love that, like, there's all these major world powers who are, like, going towards, like, the British just casually bombing your territory. Hey, England, so let me get this straight. You released this nanobot virus, put all of us in danger, and now you're bombing us. Cool. Okay. Cool. We're okay with this.
I saw someone make a good point on the internet the other day, which is, why do they fire missiles at the island? I know it's because that we must destroy this, but surely at this point we can just send some commandos to, like, bomb it, like, remote detonate it.
But then that wouldn't look as cool.
There's no, like, there's, because everyone's dead. At that point, everyone's dead. Like, there's no reason why Bond has to stay behind and die on the island. I guess, you know, he heroically sacrificed himself because he was touched by the plot device that means Bond must die now because he can't touch anyone because he has the Hercules virus.
All right.
Hercules otherwise, virus. There's no reason.
All right, let's talk about this ending. People are getting angry because James Bond dies. I actually don't have a problem with this. Here is why. It is not inconsistent with the series that he dies. It is inconsistent with the series if he doesn't come out on top in the end and defeat the villain. And well, I'm okay with...
Sorry.
Yeah. That
would have been the old way of ending one of these movies. It's like Bond always comes out on top.
Keeping the British agenda up, sir. What was the terrible Moonraker line? I think he's attempting re-entry, sir.
Yeah.
Can I just say, just before, on cue, if Wishaw sticks with it, I think he could be the best Q. I think he's great in this. I really like him. He's charming. Yeah. I love the scene with him. I love that he has a boyfriend and cats he's excited for. It doesn't bother. It's not inconsistent with the conventions of the genre that he dies.
We've seen so many different stories about Bond, and Bond keeps reinventing itself and has a loose canon, as we discussed earlier. So what's wrong with, for once, giving us a story where James Bond dies? Especially because, you know, there's no need for nerds to cry about this, because at the end, we're reassured that James Bond will return, right?
He's going to regenerate Doctor style. It's basically, exactly. It's basically, I think, Doctor Who now.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly legitimate to want to dramatize a moment where James Bond dies in a mission. There's no problem with that.
And we're just seeing, like, it was really, with Her Majesty's Secret Service, the same when Patrick Troughton came in and talked to, they had to decide, okay, how do we treat this? The amazing mocked line in Her Majesty's Secret Service, as if it happened to the other fella, just kind of acknowledges, okay, there's a regeneration, there's a change, it's just happening again, there'll be a new Bond, it's perfectly fine, and they should continue with the current set of MQ and Moneypenny. By the way, as a trio, this MQ and Moneypenny, they might be the best trio. I really like Fiennes and Harris and Wishaw. I think they're wonderful. I hope they stay on.
They are great. And I wish that they'll do something like what you're suggesting and what they did with Judi Dench staying on as M even after they...
And Bernard Lee and Desmond Llewellyn.
But the M1 is different. But the M1 is different because the Craig series tries to have its own beginning and end, and yet it maintains some continuity. Like, they acted like M has been Bond's M forever when she retired in that, even though the Craig series hadn't been going that long. So there is space for them to do the same thing with this trio of Moneypenny, Q, M, who are great, work well together, have great chemistry. But I'm worried that they're not going to do that, that they're going to throw everything out and say, you know, new Bond, new universe, everything's new. Now that they've given a firm end to it and said Daniel Craig's Bond dies.
No,
I hope they don't.
With the consistent logic of the series, there's no reason to do so. If you find actors who are better, good for you, but I think these guys are great.
I do too.
Now, but I do, however, think that there's an inconsistency with the canon and with the convention with Bond dying in the way he does. Now, the thing with Bond's character is that even by the skin of his teeth, he always gets there, he pushes, he survives the odds, he does these crazy stunts to get out of places. And there is enough of a setup in this particular scene where it showed he has enough time and enough space and enough distance, even though he's been shot, to get out because he's James Bond. And I think we saw, so I that's a problem for me.
Well, there's
a request which they wanted for a big moment. But it's more, I think it's actually worse than that. They wanted to impress the idea of this tragic figure who's alone. We see Bond start the film like this. The setup of this film, as crazy as nanobots are, is that Bond can't touch anyone if he wants his wife, and it's the other thing, his daughter, which I'm also fine with, cool, Bond as a daughter, to survive.
I heard
imagine if imagine if the end of the series had been what perfectly could have been legitimate, in pretending to die, getting that little submarine which was available, and going away, knowing that he'd be tragically alone forever. That makes the same point, it makes more sense, and it's more enduring. And I think, as one example, it's what they could have done to not break with the convention and canon.
Bond alone on an island, like in Dr. No, but not meeting
Or at the beginning of this film.
Yeah, at the beginning of this film, exactly. On the note of Bond's daughter, I read a very interesting review of this film, which made me reconsider some aspects of it, even though I disagree with the review on the overall quality of the film, which is Walter Cho's review at Film Freak Central. He, as a very well-researched Bond nut, points out that Bond's daughter in this film comes from an unfinished manuscript that Ian Fleming was writing, or that it was something that
Thunderbolt.
Right. It was something that Fleming wanted to introduce into Bond. And a lot of ideas in this movie seem to be ideas from the latter books of the series and those that we planned and yet to come.
Fine.
I think that idea of moving it in that direction is great and paying tribute is great. But ultimately, with what we were talking about how dour this whole thing is, who felt sad when Bond died? For me, it was so overplayed. And so as you say, you're distracted by the fact that Bond is just giving up, even though, yeah, it would suck not to be able to touch your wife or daughter ever again. You're distracted anyone. By, sorry?
Or anyone.
Or anyone, yeah. You're distracted by the futility of it. On a plot level, it doesn't quite make much sense, but it's such a played up big moment that I was surprised as the film was working a little bit emotionally on me early on to find myself feeling nothing. It's the death of James Bond.
No, for the reasons discussed, I thought I didn't feel it, but also it's not, and I'm good with it not being final because James will return, but it's not final. So it feels rather cheap and a gimmicky than resolutory, which is the theme, I think, tone that you would normally want in a situation like this. So I don't think it lands very well.
I mean, we can see it as gimmicky.
Do you think the next Bond is going to be his daughter growing up and taking over the mantle, essentially?
No. I don't have a problem with Bond being a woman for a much more detailed analysis, which we're not going to get into in the course of this podcast. But no, I don't think that's going to happen.
For me, James Bond as a woman is far more gimmicky than a story when James Bond dies. Because, like, I think, like, the only thing James Bond has other than a world, and a thing even stronger than the world of James Bond, is this idea of the character of James Bond. And once you said, you're saying, like, let's make a James Bond with a woman, it's kind of an admission that the whole thing is a marketing exercise, I think.
I disagree for the reason that I think, again, it comes down to core convention. Bond has always been someone who is emotionally removed and will use people and people who are attracted to. In some cases, he's shown to be attracted to other people. Therefore, I'm fine with Bond being a woman from that perspective. I think there will be an element of the classic series of the criticism of the classic misogyny and chauvinism that will inevitably lost if James Bond becomes a woman. But I don't think that's such a core element of the series. I think you can explore other aspects depending on the gender of the character. So it wouldn't bother me. If they handled it well, got the right actress, then fine.
Well, it's the question of, is Bond a character or is Bond a series of tropes? And I think the character has a consistency, even though he evolves with the different versions of him. There's things that we considered Ian Fleming's James Bond 007, right?
I don't think gender is an immutable characteristic here. I think an element of emotional remove. I think an element of self-loathing. I think there's an element and elements and willingness to use the people to ultimately advance the quote-unquote queen country. And I don't think that is exclusive to any particular gender.
Sure. But I do think on a lot, it would be a very difficult writing exercise to try to do female 007 because I think, not just in terms of misogyny, but in many, many ways, Bond is tied to masculinity. You know, to ideals of like lone hero and things like that. I'm not saying these things can only be done by men, but like it's very tied to masculine myth making in many ways.
I applied the Doctor Who principle. I'm not saying James Bond should be a woman. I'm saying it could cast the best performer.
But Doctor Who has always been.
Doctor Who is different.
Yeah, Doctor Who is very different in ways I won't get into in the limited time we have here. But
the Doctor is an alien, essentially. So yeah.
No, the Doctor, gender has never been a central part of the Doctor as it has been a part of James Bond canon, no question. I know people are angry when Jodie Whittaker came in, but
they're just dumb nerds fighting a cultural war.
Sorry, I'm saying who cares? I care, but cast the best performer, make sure anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Rami Malek, okay. Did his plan make any sense to you in the end?
No, I want to kill everyone. I want the world to be tidy. This was stupid. Again, they're falling back on the classic Thanos, let's kill everyone, which isn't as entertaining as let's kill. Someone who was screwed over by Spectre, wanted to kill all the Spectre agents and clashing with Bond. Awesome.
Yeah.
Why didn't they make that the movie? And imagine if it had just been because I want to kill everyone associated with any Spectre agent. So I'm going to kill Madeline and her daughter. And Bond's like, wait a minute, she's nothing to do with this. That's a cool plot.
Yeah. It's the problem of escalation in Hollywood storytelling where everything has to be the biggest, the most world ending, because how are we going to compete with the other movies where the fate of the world is at stake, which is a completely, I think, wrong approach to storytelling. But
that was kind of the problem where the first half of the film, he did Lucifer, however you want to pronounce his name, Staffan, essentially. does have a personal gripe with Bond and Madeline. And you thought this is going to be a more personal story. So it's a personal revenge saga rather than a world-ending saga, which was a nice twist. When it did go the world-ending way, I was just like, why did we have to go and make that twist? Because the personal story was still making so much more impact.
But there were things I liked about the personal impact. I liked the fact that it lent us this amazing villain lair. And just on the practical elements of ending the world, the acid pit where... Tell me if my interpretation is wrong. My understanding was that they were literally screening the world's water, the DNA samples from all around the world, which is eerie and terrifying and amazing for a villain-less setup. On this, and just to elaborate on the title drop, I love the scene where the woman of color shoves the crazy eugenicist into the acid pit. Like, awesome. Yeah. More of that.
Nice title drop. The idea you're suggesting about the nanobots in the water and the acid water is incredible. Why did the film not milk that? That's terrifying. That's especially terrifying in the COVID age.
Yeah. And where we're seeing these data leaks.
That's it. Yeah. There was territory for this film to get really interesting and scary in that last part, but instead we're caught up in this soap opera of, I've got your daughter. No, you've got the daughter. No, she's running around, you know, and Rami Malek giving, I must say, a fairly, by the series standards, beautifully written Before You Die, Mr. Bond speech, but it's still ultimately a Before You Die, Mr. Bond speech. And this section of the film is so prolonged and it's like, hold on, I've been here for nearly 3 hours. This is not that serious enough to, or interesting enough to justify this, especially while they're straining for this importance in Malek's character at the same time that, as we've just discussed, his motivations don't make sense. The film's just not consistent enough to pull off the seriousness it's aiming for, I think.
I enjoyed that there was momentum throughout this film. I liked the scene in the Faroe Islands doubling for Norway, even though we didn't need to see CGI jeeps crushing people, which just doesn't work for the reasons discussed earlier. I liked the great scene where they're running throughout Italy. What I loved with Casino Royale and some of the earlier Bond films is that showed character development through action, and the amazing scene where Bond is in the car with Madeline just waiting to hear her like confess, and knowing that these people are coming with the guns to shoot and just break down the car. Amazing character driven action, wonderfully written. This is what I live for James Bond films.
And it establishes at the beginning that Bond is ready to die.
Yes, true.
That much is at stake for him. You know, he's not tied to the world of the living so much anymore, which maybe is meant to sell the ending, but ultimately doesn't, because over the course of this narrative, we feel it comes up from that point and has something to live for now. I guess at the end, we can say it's been taken away from him, but I agree with your core premise that Bond doesn't give up like that.
No, and we saw with the amazing scene where he tries to rescue Felix from an oil rig.
Yes, that's right.
A really well staged. There's a lot of good sequences in this regard. I enjoyed myself. I'll watch it again in a few months. I'd recommend it.
For me, honestly, the length of it is the big sticking point. Like, I struggle to recommend a Bond film that's this long. Even I'm telling people, like, yeah, go see it, but you know, enjoy the first half because
But that's the thing. The first half is so long; it's 90 minutes, so it's still a proper feature length first half.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah, so there's more to recommend than not.
Yeah. It's not like the second half of the film is terrible, but it's worse than terrible, which is disappointing, you know? But
I had a good time. I was never bored in this film.
I enjoyed
the crazy ending on the island.
There's still things to recommend about it, because as you say, the production design of this this Garden of Death and this huge complex is terrific, right? There's still interesting things going on. But even the action in the second half of the film, I feel, becomes just kind of like more boring, handheld shaky shots, not such clear visual dynamics as what we have in the first half of the film. It feels like on every level they just kind of drop the ball past a certain point. I wonder, like, was this production rushed?
Well,
like,
the Cuba scene had such amazing geography and use of the space. How good was the Michael Myers-esque opening with the villain like coming into the house with the mask?
Oh, that was cool. It's like the slasher movie with the girl running from this villain. But what's up with his mask was really cool, but then it ends up just kind of falling by the wayside.
Then he wanted to disguise these, again, scars, villains of scars, guys. You know, Pilm's bad at a facial scar and they're Russian.
Are we ever going to move past the physical deformity equals evil?
I hope so. We did have a beautiful man believing in us and being a bad guy in this.
You know,
very poorly written bad guy.
You know what would be the awesome, an awesome apology? Because, you know, I was thinking, you know, scars, yeah, they've been in combat. And I thought, hang on, let's have a scarred James Bond taking on beautiful Aryan villains.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. I'd watch that movie.
I would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where's that film?
Do we have much more to say about this one?
There's not a lot more to say. I had a great time. I think it's Craig's second best Bond film.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah.
After Casino Royale.
Casino Royale's the best.
Yeah.
No, I think Skyfall was still better than this.
I'm not sure. Skyfall is very much going for like a fun Bond. This one, you know, it's a very different beast. But what Casino Royale definitely had over this, and I think we can all agree on, is Casino Royale nailed the emotional stakes in the relationship better than this one.
Oh, yeah, totally. Absolutely. Casino Royale is one of the best Bond films.
I think it's the second best, honestly, after GoldenEye.
Martin Campbell.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing. And this is harsh because of Skyfall, because I like Skyfall a lot. I think that the action in Skyfall is just lazier. And I find the ending of this more satisfying than the ending of Skyfall, though I did like the ending of Skyfall very much.
I think the ending of Skyfall was way better than this.
The ending of Skyfall is more satisfying, but I agree and feels like it has more emotional punch to me.
I agree on the emotional punch, yes.
I think you're right that Skyfall relies a lot on the visual trickery of Roger Deakins' expressionistic lighting. The actual action direction isn't that great. The action direction in this film is much more inventive, especially in the earlier parts of the film.
Just compare the scenes set under a frozen lake.
Yeah, that's right. One more note on the final action beats and Rami Malek's character. Putting it, you feel kind of shortcharged watching him be the one to finally off Bond, you know, at least in terms of like shooting him and having Bond bleeding out, and they get to have these talks about how you and I were both
that alone. Was awesome. I've got to say, I did like the analogy they drew between the two.
That speech was cool, but because he's a lacking villain in other respects, that it kind of feels like really like they're building this guy up to be bigger than he should be.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone should have killed Bond, it should have been Blofeld. Blofeld should have got the privilege.
No, he already.
I mean, if Blofeld came back and he, you know, somehow they died together, that would be. But you know, I guess we're holding on to the idea of what Blofeld was in the original series, and Blofeld just is kind of a more boring dude in this reboot.
And now we have to ask ourselves: did they in fact delay because of the plot of the film? How analogous is it to COVID?
I think they said. Yeah, I think, look, it was the first film to be delayed before other films moved out of the way, and as it became as it became clear how serious the pandemic is, it, I think, was a preemptive delay because they thought it's not the right climate to release a film about a bioweapon.
Or just something where if you touch or have contact with someone, then you can infect you can be impacted or affect others. It's not directly analogous to COVID, but there are elements thereof, which will be very present in the mind of any viewer.
Yeah, there's resonances that they probably wanted to avoid.
And they probably are kicking themselves not releasing it in November 2019 when it was supposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why did they not release November 2019?
They wanted to do some reshoots and there were some minor tweaks. Bad call.
Hindsight's 2020. Did those reshoots even get to happen?
I think so. I think that there were, yes, I believe so from memory.
Right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. It was good. I like this cue. I like the setup of the film. There's a very cool heist scene at the beginning.
Yeah.
Well staged. There's a lot. Like, there's just a lot going on here, which I think is more of a benefit of the film than the traction. I don't think it's overwhelming or mostly not overstuffed.
Yeah. Shaw's review as a Bond aficionado that I mentioned earlier made a good point about the title. About the multiple ways you can read it, but he thought the most resonant was like that this is no time to die. Like the world's in a really dark place. We need heroes. Like No Country for Old Men almost.
I like that.
I like that too. It makes sense with Felix and Bond going out.
Well, what's the Lionel Hutz line? No.
Time to die. Yeah, exactly. The way the title drops you. But yeah, I really recommend that review for a pretty deep reading of the film that points out a lot of its sources.
Cool villain. It brings back a lot of the stuff I missed from Bond films. Cool villain lairs, insane, albeit stereotypical villains.
while taking it seriously. There's that tension of these kind of wacky elements and the seriousness of this. Sometimes it works.
And I'm just going to say, like, the iconography of this film, remember that we're dealing with a villain who was impacted by the events of the Cold War. And then the final sequence takes place in a, what they refer to as disputed area. And it is a disputed area. Let's not forget that Japan and Russia haven't actually signed a formal armistice agreement. So it feels like there's elements of the past that are unresolved that are coming back, which is very resonant with Bond's narrative and throughout the entire film. So I think there's a clever way they anchored this element throughout.
Yeah.
So I give the film credit there. Yeah, is that No Time to Die?
That's it. I think that's about it.
Yeah, it's in cinemas now. It will be in cinemas for a long time.
I think so.
Everyone's going to see it because it's a Bond film.
I think this movie is going to be playing till at least Boxing Day. Probably longer. Yeah.
It's just, it'll get some word of mouth. People are like, oh, another Bond.
Bond does really well when everyone's recommending it. And I think this one's good enough that it won't do as well as Skyfall, but it'll do better than Spectre.
Yeah. I like Spectre. People handle Spectre. I enjoyed myself.
I thought it was fine. It was okay.
My Craig ranking goes Casino Royale, this, Skyfall, Spectre, Quantum. I do like Quantum.
Yeah.
I rewatched it recently. I like all these films.
I'll have to rewatch Skyfall to know where it ranks, but I think my ranking probably mirrors yours, Glenn.
And now, they've said they're going to cast someone next year, or like look to cast someone from next year.
What were you going to say, Brett?
I was just going to switch Skyfall and this one. But other than that, yeah.
Right.
That was great.
Yeah, I think they'll wait a few years to cast the next Bond.
There's no reason they can't go 2-year gaps between films like they used to. They did between Casino Royale and Quantum.
I think, though, given that they actually ended this with Bond dies, they're going to want to give like a 4-year gap at least.
Yeah.
Give it some space.
Oh, Bond. I did like waiting to the credits and seeing James Bond will return at the end.
Yeah. It's reassuring, right?
Bond.
Imagine if this one did not end with that.
Yeah.
That would be fun. That would be great.
Yeah.
So I think it's time, Bond, just shout out, guys. Come to Australia. Like, you've never been to Australia or New Zealand. There's plenty of stuff to blow up here.
Yeah, I mean, David Bowie came. Bond can come. Yeah. But
Bowie's way cooler.
I mean, the Less Sounds video. I don't know why Bowie's on my mind this morning, but wouldn't it be funny if they'd been like, you know, if Barbara Broccoli and various, you know, associated people that were giving the press line afterwards, like, you know, it's like, will James Bond return? It didn't say that in the credits. It's like, we're just not sure. You know, we really have to think about this.
We want to earn more money with this massive IP we own.
Yeah, that's right. We really believe in the ending of this film. And right now we're standing by it. And then the elation of the easily played masses when they reveal that actually Bond will return. I'm glad they didn't do that. I'm glad they're being upfront. James Bond will return.
Yes.
So will we.
As well, everyone's favorite producer-driven series.
Yeah.
So Bond.
Yeah.
Cool.
We'll return next week.
Next week we're doing Power of the Dog.
Yeah.
And we are doing Last Night in Soho.
We'll do just a little bit on Power of the Dog, because if you guys are interested, these guys have seen it and discussed it pretty extensively already. I've now seen it. I'll add my thoughts. I'll give a capsule review on Venom, because I'm not sure these guys are going to see it, but I have. Venom. Yeah. The new one. Let there be carnage.
Isn't it like 90 minutes long?
Yeah, that's one of the best things about it.
Good on them.
Yeah, I really respect that. And we'll mostly talk about Last Night in Soho. There are some divided opinions among the Film Fight Club boys. So expect a fight once again.
But not on Power of the Dog. I think we all liked this one.
Yes, we all liked it.
It's really, really good.
Good movies out at the moment. Bad Luck Banging, now out in cinemas in Australia. A real going out on a limb choice for the distributor to put a film like that out in general release and not just keep it to film festivals. So support it if you're into interesting, unusual films. And I also really recommend Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy at the Japanese Film Festival, which me and Brett caught at SFF and really loved. So, lots of good movies.
Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Enjoy James Bond. We will return as well. Good night.